All right, for today we're going to talk a bit more about some issues that we started on the first day of class, talking about movement of drugs around systems in the general topic of biopharmacology, and more specifically, pharmacokinetics. Everyone familiar with the term kinetics? Movement. Okay, so pharmacokinetics, movement of pharmacological agents, of drugs, most typically thought of in these terms. Okay. We'll begin with something that I like to call the iLabMe system. It's not something that I made up. It was actually made up by pharmacologists back in the 1930s and 1940s to encourage people to think about the different sets of variables that influence the movement of drugs into and out of a system. Each of the letters in iLabMe stands for a different set of concepts involved in this movement, okay? And again, I'll give you a good clue that if you pay attention to this, it will be useful to you for the entire rest of the semester. That's anything in color on slides tends to be useful and, in fact, relevant to some people's mind, testable information, okay? Doesn't mean you should never write anything down that's not in color, but that is particularly relevant information. Right, in iLabMe, the I stands for putting something into the system, input, intake, any of those other words that are shown there that begin with I, getting it in. In the case of the majority of medications, that's via an oral route, ingestion. But there are lots of other ways to get things into the system, as we discussed on Tuesday. Some routes slow, some routes fast, some in between. Typically, if you take a tablet or a pill orally, that pill does not move into your brain. The drug has to be liberated from that physical state that it is in. It will typically dissolve. And very often it will ionize or go back into its constituent non-ionized form. We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. Okay, so it needs to be liberated in some way. It then needs to be absorbed. It needs to move across cell membranes. If you put a drug into your mouth, unless you're treating an upset stomach or bowel problems, you'd like it to be able to get access to the rest of your body. It must be absorbed from the gastrointestinal system into other regions of the body. And we'll talk about some physical parameters that affect that rate of absorption and where that absorption will occur. Then it must be distributed. What's the primary distribution media, the system in your body that carries that out? The circulatory system, pumped by the heart, but the veins and arteries carry the fluid that then distributes various things that are within the body to different regions, whether it's oxygen or glucose or drugs. Circulatory system doesn't care, it distributes all of them. Toxins that are a result of metabolism are also distributed by the circulatory system. Metabolites of drugs after they've been broken down. And that leads us to the next letter in iLabMe, metabolism. Biotransformation is another term that's often used. Changing a molecule from one particular molecule into one or more products. Very often, this term is loosely used to mean breakdown of a drug. As we'll see as an example for many different drugs, metabolism can actually yield an active metabolite, one that can continue to have biological activity. So metabolism does not necessarily mean degradation of the drug. It can mean that, but it does not mean that exclusively. The final letter, E, excretion. Okay, probably when you were in kindergarten or maybe preschool, you learned a couple of numbers associated with that. You only had to hold up two numbers to get to the upper limit there. Okay. Are those the only routes of excretion from the body? Sweating? Breathing? Are you? Sneezing? Okay, that's possible.
Tears?
Vomiting?
Earwax
probably a pretty minimal role there, but that is possible. Okay. Even sloughing of skin cells. How about the stuff that grows on your head? Drugs are excreted in that way as well. In fact, you can fail drug tests based on hair samples that you leave behind. There are multiple routes than just the ones that you can count on one or two fingers for excretion. Right, any questions about iLADME? Okay. So if there are 10 points on the next exam about iLADME, a few people may miss that. All right. Lots on this slide. Not all of it's in color, though, correct? All right, everyone familiar with the term pH? Okay, it's a physical characteristic of a solution. Relative amount of ions, particularly of protons and electrons within a solution. Charged particles. How about pKa? Everyone familiar with pKa? It's an equilibrium constant or dissociation constant that describes whether a given molecule will be in an ionized or a non-ionized state in a given solution. A good rule of thumb to use is that if a molecule has a low pKa, it tends to ionize in acidic solutions. Where would you find acidic solutions in your body? In the stomach. Okay, if a molecule has a very high pKa, it tends to ionize in basic solutions. Where would you find basic pHs in your body? In your intestines, particularly your lower intestine. How about blood plasma? What's the pH of blood plasma? Depending on who you ask, 7.2, 7.3, 7.4. It will vary depending on things that you may have put into your body that day as well. Typically about 7.3, though. So close to neutral pH. Some drugs will have a pKa where they will ionize at neutral pHs as well. How many of you would like to be responsible for doing a lot of complex math on the first exam? Never get any volunteers for that one. Okay, we'll be democratic about this one, and I'll spare you from that. However, if you're ever interested, you can actually calculate very precisely, knowing the pKa of a given drug. If you ever open up a prescription drug that has one of those package inserts, you fold it out into the size that's large enough to serve as a sun shield in your car, and you look at the very fine print, one of the pieces of information they will often give you is the pKa of a drug, the pH at which it tends to want to ionize. So any given drug will have that information that's been determined empirically. This particular example I pulled out of a textbook was a drug that I would suggest you not ingest. PCP, benzcyclidine, was originally invented to be used as an animal tranquilizer. Actually worked reasonably well for that purpose. No longer widely used for that, though, because it began to be diverted widely for human use. And police departments particularly don't like trying to deal with individuals that have ingested large quantities of PCP. They find people under those conditions hard to communicate with. And police, when they can't communicate with you, often like to shoot you. Hopefully, they might have a taser but you can't count on their being able to use that properly either. So probably not a good drug to use. It's also highly illegal, which discourages some people at least. All right? PKA has a very high, I'm sorry, PCP has a very high PKA, a basic PKA. So when PCP is ingested into the body, it goes into the mouth, or into the nose perhaps, but more commonly into the mouth. It has a fairly neutral pH. It goes to the stomach, which has a very acidic pH. And then finally moves into the intestines. So you can determine sites at which it will move out of different sets of membranes and across them. Typically, drugs only move in a non-ionized state. So the last point at which PCP would be taken out of the system would be in the intestines. Non-ionized to move across membranes. Another thing that just restricts movement of drugs is once they get into the circulatory system, they often bind in a non-selective manner to plasma proteins. Plasma protein binding. Those drug inserts will have a great deal more information about plasma protein binding. So it turns out that this is one that is very influential in how much drug gets to its site of action. An awful lot of commercially available drugs have plasma protein binding values approaching 98 or 99%. Many drugs in excess of 90%. That means for every $100 you spend on a drug, all but a dollar of it is wasted. The better ones, all but $10 of the drug is wasted. So where does that go? It gets excreted out of the system. Doesn't matter if that's a street drug or a prescription drug. Plasma protein binding restricts its ability to move out of the circulatory system. And it's bound to a large protein molecule. It's not going to go anywhere. This slide also illustrates why I don't usually use my own artwork to illustrate different concepts. And I'll try not to inflict it on you very often. In pharmacology, we often talk about drugs moving between different fluid compartments within the body. We treat the mouth as one compartment, the stomach is another one, intestines is another, circulatory system is another, different organ systems is others. The brain as a particular compartment. And we'll talk about special properties of that compartment in a moment. Okay. So once a drug is absorbed, it moves from, say, the GI system into the circulatory system. It can be there as a free drug, but it can also interact with plasma proteins, and an awful lot of most drugs you take in then end up trapped in that compartment, bound to those plasma proteins. It's only the drug that's not bound to the proteins that and is capable of moving into other compartments. Okay. For a lot of drugs, we talked about speed and another factor that influences them, that first pass liver metabolism. The liver is another compartment, and an awful lot of the enzymatic activity there is devoted to transforming molecules into simpler molecules. So first pass liver metabolism can then influence what is going to be back in circulation and capable of moving to other compartments. Now let's say we want to have an effect on the brain, and let's pretend this is the brain. Obviously the brain is a square white box, rectangular box, I guess. We'd like the drug to be able to move into that compartment to have access to neurons there. But there's no magic ticket that guarantees it's going to get there. It has equal access and, in fact, preferential access to other organ systems. It can move into them and have what, if we were desiring the effect on the brain, we would call side effects of the drug. Are those really side effects? Does the drug know it's doing the wrong thing? No, those are primary effects. They're just not what we wanted. So in marketing language, they're called side effects. We're going to have to learn to discriminate between marketing language and real scientific language as well. Additionally, an awful lot of drugs are very lipophilic. Everyone familiar with that term? They're soluble in lipids as well as in aqueous solutions, in water-based solutions. Members of our species tend to have a lot of adipose tissue, fatty tissues. And in fact, all our cells are surrounded by lipid bilayer membranes. So those can act as additional reservoirs to store drugs that are taken into the system. The more that's concentrated in these alternative sites, the less that's available to go to the desired site of action. Another odd consequence of that is that they could then move out of those sites at a later point in time. So someone could take a drug for a given purpose, say they were looking for a particular recreational effect. That recreational event is long over, and now some of the drug that had never reached its desired site of action comes out of another storage site in the body. Now they're trying to go to work, and they're still experiencing the effects of the drug long after they would have predicted it would be over, and have unintended consequences. It can vary depending on the drug. Tend to know for specific drugs, but it also depends on the individual and how much body fat they have, what type of activity they're engaged in, so the rate of circulation, and lots of other factors like pH. Have they eaten or drunk anything else in the meantime that might influence that? Are they really active or are they sleeping? It can even be influenced by things like altitude. So not as easily predicted as you might like. And maybe not occurring in exactly the time that you might prefer in some circumstances as well. Everyone heard of the blood-brain barrier? Often abbreviated the BBB. Nothing to do with a Better Business Bureau. We know that typically in the circulatory system, there's a fairly loose relationship between the different cells making up the walls of the circulatory systems, typically smooth muscles and endothelial tissue. And there are very small gaps between those cells called gap junctions, typically down in the nanometer range, but still large enough to allow passage of some molecules, including in many cases water. Not large quantities, but not a huge barrier to movement compared to what we have in the blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier, we not only have the vascular tissue to contend with, but things are arranged much more tightly. Rather than having gap junctions, we define it as being tight junctions. Very tight overlap of cells in most regions of the blood-brain barrier. And there are selective regions in the brain where the blood-brain barrier is minimal compared to other regions, particularly around the ventricular zones in the brain. Then we have an additional layer of membrane, what's called the basement membrane, surrounding the vascular tissue. One extra set of cell membranes to move across And then in most areas, we also have glial cells rejecting what are called their infeet surrounding that region as well. So a third layer of cells. And the cells are more tightly joined together across those three layers than in any other part of the circulatory system. It's as if the brain was designed not to get things in from outside, or at least not in large quantities. It's much more difficult in terms of the amount of energy or transport mechanisms involved to get things into the nervous system than any other organ system in the body. To overcome that, we have transporters that are designed to carry specific molecules. Later in the semester, we'll look at transporters for specific amino acids that are used to generate neurotransmitters. Of course, there are transporters for things like glucose. Water, thankfully, moves fairly readily across these membranes in an osmotically regulated system, as do things like oxygen, required for normal oxidative metabolism, and then the byproducts of that, things like carbon dioxide. But larger molecules typically have to be carried, or they have to obey the normal laws of diffusion across these cellular membranes. They need to be non-ionized, or they need to be transported. So it's a very large barrier to movement of things in and out of the brain. When we're trying to get something to the brain, very often we have a specific area that we'd like to have it have its effect. Look at a specific drug, a neuroleptic drug called clopromazine. I'm not going to ask if we have any schizophrenics out here, but if we did, you might likely have had experience with clopromazine. We'll be talking about it later this semester. It's a drug that's designed to have its effect on one specific class of dopamine receptors, and particularly the desired effects are in the prefrontal cortex. And when we put a drug into the body, it does not have a targeting system. It does not know the address to which it's designed to be delivered. So once it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it has access not only to the site we'd like it to, prefrontal cortex, but to all the other brain regions as well. Both those that also contain dopamine receptors, but also for many drugs, they have what we call cross-reactivity. They will have some ability to bind to receptors for other systems. In the case of clopromazine, it can also bind to cholinergic receptors, receptors for the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, and have some degree of activity at them as well. So if we're trying to shoot this drug at a specific target, we talk about it not being a magic bullet because it's not highly selective. It has effects elsewhere than we would desire, and it affects other types of receptors than we would like. So again, in marketing language, we would talk about all the other types of effects as being side effects. Is that an accurate description? No, again, these are all primary effects. But given that this is what people are paying for, that's called the main effect. There may be examples of drugs where most of it ends up focused on a particular receptor in a particular region. That most likely occurs when that receptor has special characteristics, like there could be lots of that receptor there and nowhere else. Or that receptor has a particular affinity for that drug, or the drug has a particular affinity for that receptor. And it likes to bind to that special type of receptor at that special location. And there are some good rare examples of that at this point in time. But this sort of a scheme is much more common for many drugs, where they're not well targeted. And as a consequence, when we talk about their clinical profile, we talk about a lot of side effects. And if you listen to the disclaimers on television when they're advertising drugs, they spend more time listing these disclaimers than the actual benefit of the drug. It may cause sudden death. Well, I'm willing to pay for that. Again, those are not really accepted marketing terms, side effects. Is that clear to everyone? Notice there's very little in red on this slide, and that's on purpose, because we're going to be covering metabolism in great detail later in the semester. Specific metabolism of all the different neurotransmitter systems. So I don't want you to fixate on the various types of chemical reactions at this point in time. For one reason, these are very generic ones still. And we want to know much more about the specific ones, particularly those relevant to the nervous system. Again, I mentioned earlier that metabolism doesn't just mean breakdown or degradation of a drug. It can mean transformation into another active state. In fact, it can mean transformation into an active state from an inactive one. So we use metabolism at this point in the very generic sense. Obviously, an awful lot of the metabolism occurs by enzymatic activity in the liver. But we're also going to look at additional routes of metabolism in the nervous system itself. Some within neurons, some occurring out in synapses, some involving, in fact, the much more numerous population of cells in the nervous system. Not neurons, anyone know what those are? Glial cells. The overwhelming majority of the cells that are inside your skull are not neurons. And much of the metabolism of neurotransmitters and of drugs that occurs within your skull is carried out by glial cells. For certain neurotransmitters, it occurs in the synapse, enzymes that are located there. And in some specific instances, neurons actually carry out the metabolism. Another example of metabolism we'll talk about later on in the semester, the actual synthesis of neurotransmitters. That's taking, in many cases, raw amino acids and converting them into forms that are then packaged up to be used as neurotransmitters. That technically is also metabolism. Is that clear to everyone? You remember at the end of iLADME, we had metabolism and excretion. And the two of them are often lumped together, and then we come up with another category that we call clearance of a drug. Removal of the drug from a system. Okay, if you convert it from an active form to an inactive form, that inactive form could still be circulating, and it's not going to have any biological effect. But guarantee, if you get it out of the body, either by number one or number two, or by all the other routes we talked about, it will also not have any longer any effect on the body. So clearance, removal from the system. And in fact, pharmacologists have been quite quantitatively minded about trying to determine rates of clearance of drugs. If we start with any given amount of drug in a system, this is just an arbitrary amount shown in this example. In this particular case, 16 nanograms per deciliter. Pick any random numbers here and it would work equally well. So we have a known quantity. And if we continue to measure the concentration of that drug every few minutes across a number of hours of time, eventually the concentration of the drug will get down to a level that is so low we can no longer measure it. You can essentially then say that the concentration is zero at that point. Probably isn't. Those few random molecules will still be floating around, We'll essentially call that zero at that point. That time point from when it was at its peak to when it got down to zero would be the lifespan of that drug in the system. So what do you think we would call half that period of time? The half-life of the drug. The time to get from maximum to zero. Half of that is called the half-life. Everyone got that concept now. Now there's a related term in terms of its name that confuses the hell out of people. That's called the half-time of the drug. Okay, since Dallas is going to be holding the Super Bowl in just a couple weeks' time, maybe that will help you add another mnemonic tag onto this to keep track that it's different from half-life. Half-time is the time it takes to fall from any given concentration. Here we've just arbitrarily picked a concentration of 4 to a concentration of half of that. Half of 4 is, very good, everybody's passed math. It's time to go from one concentration to half that concentration. It's called the half time. We could have started when it was up here at 16. What's the half of 16? Okay, the time it took to go to 8. Exactly the same period of time as what it took to go from 4 to 2. Or to go from 2 to 1. Or to go from 5 to 2.5. It's the time it took to go from any given concentration to half of that concentration. The half time. So remember, the life has to do with the whole duration. The half time has to do with these smaller increments of time. Guarantee that a lot of people are going to miss that on the first exam. It's a big hint to you that might be on the first exam. Anyone not hear that? Of course, nobody's going to answer that question, because if you didn't hear it, you're not going to have heard that question probably either. Is that clear to everyone? Which one has to do with half the time that the drug is in your body? Half life. Which one has to do with the time it takes to go to half the concentration? Half time. See, everybody knows it now. Just like everybody knew about the door. Let's hope your memory for this one is better. A somewhat related concept. This is not dealing with necessarily removing the drug from the system, although that's involved, but also with putting drug into the system. This is the concept of the steady state concentration. Steady state concentration. Okay, anytime you take a drug into a system, it's going to take a little while to get from your mouth, across all the barriers, at its peak concentration in blood plasma or in the brain, you know, where you're measuring, and then it's going to get metabolized and excreted. It's going to get cleared. So you're going to get a curve that looks sort of like this. It'll go up, hit a peak, and go down. If you only took the drug once, it'll go back down to zero. We'd have the full lifetime of the drug. An awful lot of drugs that you're prescribed, though, you're told, take one once a day. Take one twice a day. So you'll have multiple doses of the drug. Typical regimens, you will take more of the drug before you've cleared all of the previous drug out. So the new drug that you're adding in will add on to the drug concentration you're carrying from the previous dose. So this is what's remaining from the first dose. You add the second dose onto that, the concentration ends up being higher. You take the third dose and it gets higher still. Fourth dose, it gets higher still. But it doesn't go on to infinity. It reaches an asymptote, an upper limit of concentration, where now you've put in the maximal amount of drug and you continue to sustain putting drug in, and the system is clearing it out as you're adding new drug in.
And for every drug tested thus far, the time to hit that plateau, that steady state concentration, turns out to be about 4 half times of the drug. Remember half time? Time it took to get to half the concentration. You will reach a different steady state depending on what the dose of the drug was. If you were taking a 100 milligram tablet, this would be the curve. If you were taking a 200 milligram tablet, it would have a higher curve. You'd get to a higher steady state. It would take the same period of time to get there. This is independent of the dose, as long as you keep taking the same dose. If you take 100 milligrams one time and 200 another time and 300 another time, the curve will be very oddly shaped. The time to reach steady state concentration is about 4 half times for the drug. How long will it take once you stop taking the drug to clear it out of your system? It will take 2 half-lives. 2 half-lives is 1 full life. Not determined by half time, but by half life, clearance. Complete clearance. If I wanted to know how long it would take to go from that last pill to get to half the concentration that it reached at that last pill, that would be the half time. Now people are starting to get confused. Keep in mind the simple concept first, the difference between half life and half time. And then we have the added complication of steady state concentration. Steady state concentration is how long it takes to get to that plateau. But once you stop taking the drug, half life and half time determine the rate at which it clears back out of the system. Total clearance will be determined by the full lifespan of the drug. So 2 half lives would be 1 full life of the drug. That makes sense to everyone? Okay, depending on how I word a question on the exam, more or less of you will answer it correctly. I'm going to try as humanly as possible to be kind to everyone in the way it's worded. But keep this discussion in mind. Okay. The other thing to keep in mind, the rate of drug clearance is developmentally regulated. Very often you'll see precautionary notes for people out at the end of the lifespan. They may even state an age, like age 70. And they might say age 60 or age 50. The drug clearance may be reduced in populations beyond that age, because the liver is not doing as good a job, the maggot activity is decreased, sometimes the enzymes in the brain as well. Kidney function might be degraded at that point, huh? If you had to depend on spitting or sneezing all the drug out, it might take an awful long time. You're waiting for your hair to grow out and excrete the drugs a very long time. Turns out that infants are not really great at clearing drugs either. And not only do we not give them full adult doses, we titrate it down even further. The fact that they're smaller is only one reason. It's also because the drug stays in their system a very long time. These enzymatic systems begin to develop very rapidly after birth. And by about a year of age, they're up to their maximum capacity. Typically through puberty,
But looking around the room, I think it's fair to say that everyone here is past that point.
So for you, drugs clear out of your system not as well as they used to. Tends to be stable across adulthood, but then in old age it begins to decline. And it declines for different metabolic systems and for different organ systems at different rates. So these are sort of average curves. Your mileage may vary. It's very tightly developmentally regulated as well. Everyone familiar with the concept of dose-response relationships? Looking at something related to dose, or what we might also call concentration, and we'll typically put that on the x-axis, and something related to response, or the effect that the drug causes, and we'll typically put that on the y-axis. Not surprisingly, no drug tends to have no effect. A little bit of drug, very little effect. Start increasing the drug, and for a good while you may still have very little effect. And then suddenly the effect begins to take off. Now perhaps you've hit enough receptors for the drug that you're beginning to activate or inhibit a lot of cellular activity. And for a while you'll get a fairly linear relationship between the amount of drug and the amount of response. We call that the dose-response relationship. One way to measure that is to look at the slope, the line describing that relationship. Really steep slope means the drug is really potent. Doubling the amount of drug gives you a big increase in the effect. If it's a very flat sort of a curve, a line, not as potent a drug. It takes a big increase in dose. You get a relatively moderate amount of effect. So slope might be an important variable there. For almost every drug, continue to add in more and more drug into the system, eventually you get to a maximal effect. You can't get more than that out of the biological system. You're taking a drug to speed up the heart. Eventually you hit the limits of how fast the heart can pump. It can't physically move any faster than that. Doing something to the brain, you've saturated every possible receptor for the drug. There's none left. The neurons can't grow more receptors fast enough to generate more activity. We call that the asymptote, the peak. And you can keep adding more drug into the system at that point, but you're not going to achieve more effect, at least the effect that you want. You might achieve more of what we call the side effects, or what we would often call an overdose. And we'll look at that again in just a moment. Obviously, if you're paying money for your drugs, you like a drug that had a really sharp slope, and that slope accelerated somewhere way down the bottom end of the concentration curve. Perfect drug, if you were paying for every microgram of it, would be something like this in its shape. If you're working for the drug company and making money off of how much drug you can sell, you'd like a drug that had a concentration curve way down here. So again, there's marketing involved in this. Consumer issues involved in this.
And ideally, in fact, you'd like one that was way over at that right-hand side that you had an exclusive patent on. And no one else could market for 20 years or more. Yes.
Isn't that also for the consumer safety,
though? We'll talk about that a little more in a moment. Yes.
What is the basis for
the who?
The inverted U dose response curve.
Because that, yeah, we're just measuring one particular response. For most drugs, those inverted U-shaped curves take into account that desired response, but also those side effects, those other responses, tend to have that inflection to that curve. So maybe you're looking at a drug that you want to improve learning and memory with, or you want to change heart rate with, but it has other consequences. And those are detrimental to the effect you're trying to measure. And eventually, when you get high enough, you've saturated the one curve, and the others now are pushing things in the opposite direction. And it means you're really measuring multiple sets of variables, even though you think you're only measuring one. You're measuring the other variables indirectly. And we'll talk more about that later, too. Few more terms we need to define. We'll have a lot more definitions next week. When we look at a drug and we talk about its ability to activate a receptor in the nervous system, we'll talk a lot about receptor-mediated actions in the nervous system this semester. A drug that will activate a receptor we will call an agonist. It will agonize the receptor. Doesn't mean it will be in pain. It means it will activate it. And many drugs will be what we call full agonists. They can produce the maximal amount of response, again, that we measure on the y-axis. Some drugs will do it over towards the left-hand end of the x-axis, the concentration curve. Some will do it over at the right-hand end. But any full agonist will eventually get to the maximal effect. We also have drugs that are called partial agonists. Partial because they can only get to part of that full effect. Say you had a headache, and 100% effect was curing your headache. A partial agonist for achieving that effect, you'd still have the headache. It would just be better. No matter how much drug you took, the end result would be it would be better, not that it would be gone. That would be a partial agonist versus a full agonist. Now, as you can see from this curve, if you take more and more and more drug, it's like the full agonist, it plateaus. You get to the point where you can't put any more drug into the system, there's nowhere else for it to bind. And you've achieved the maximal effect that drug can have. A partial agonist never gets the same level of effect. That's why it's called partial. The number that we often use to describe these agonist effects, rather than having to put it in enough to get the full effect, we know what the full effect is, we measure how much it takes to get to half of that. It's cheaper for a drug company to only have to use half as much drug, or some percentage of the drug less than what is required to do a full effect. This point, the concentration it takes to get to half of the maximal effect is often called the EC50. E for effective, C for concentration, to get to 50% of the maximum. hold on a second. It's often sometimes called the ED50. When we're giving drugs to humans, we don't want to have to go into an explanation that you give a given dose and it goes into solution, and then eventually we can measure the concentration. So we talk about the dose that's given. So it's the effective dose to get to half that maximal effect. ED50. Now, you had a question? Yes, because you don't want to overdose on the drug either.
So, like, if it says take two tablets every 4 hours, the two tablets within the 4 hour period, you'll achieve that full agonist.
Mm-hmm. But it takes how many half times to get to that concentration, the steady state concentration? 4 half times. Okay. So everybody have a grasp on EC or ED50. Okay. And there's another use for that number. And what we call the therapeutic index. The therapeutic index. That uses that ED50 or EC50, the dose it takes to get to half of the maximal effect. Or another way of looking at that, this is the way drug companies typically look at it. What dose is it going to take to get that effect in half the population? So say the desired effect is to put someone to sleep. Sleeping pill. Are there any medications known that have that effect? Pretty large number of them. They may not really produce sleep, but they will at least render you unconscious. Okay. So the term that the drug company would use would be hypnosis. Not like being hypnotized, but being literally rendered unconscious. So we could determine a dose where everybody on this side of the room would be guaranteed to be asleep. Actually, we'd have to land on his ground. With another half of the population would still probably be awake. They might be drowsy, but they'd still be awake. As we kept increasing the dose, more and more people would be asleep. Then we got to the maximal dose, everyone was asleep. There's another curve that you don't like lying out here as well. That's the lethal dose. What percentage of the population will that drug kill at a given dose or a given concentration? There will be a lethal dose for 1% of the population, or 0.0001% of the population. You don't want to be that random example that's killed by taking one tablet of a drug. There would be another dose that would probably kill every single individual taking it. I pretty much guarantee that if you had to swallow a ton of any given drug, that would kill you. But for most drugs, it would be much lower than a ton. The lethal dose. And you can determine experimentally the dose it would take to kill half of a population. Think drug companies do that type of research these days on human subjects? No. Awful lot of the marketing that goes on is dependent on experiments that were carried out in World War II with human subjects. It's not surprising that many of the drug companies that are still out there are based in Germany and Japan. They carried out most of those experiments. We do have a lot of American drug companies that take advantage of that data too, though. So there's guilt to go around everywhere. When you come up with a totally new class of drugs, these values are determined from animal models. And the FDA insists on that data being collected. and then it's extrapolated to humans. But until it goes out into the market, you don't know if that curve for animal is exactly the same curve for humans. So every time a new drug comes out, keep an eye on it. You may see a recall on that drug. First, you'll typically see lawsuits against the manufacturer of the drug, and then a recall. So it turned out that the curve didn't work out the same in humans as in animal subjects. So for an ideal drug, we'd like these two curves to be different from one another. We'd like not to go to sleep and never wake up. So the distance between these two, which is literally the ratio between these two, we call the therapeutic index. And these days, for most drugs, the FDA would like that therapeutic index to be 10 or more. If the dose that's needed to get a given effect is, say, 1 milligram, you'd like it to require 10 milligrams or more to kill you. And there should be all kinds of warning, never take 10 milligrams of this drug. Problem with that,
what if you have this in the curve?
1.2 milligrams might be your lethal dose. That's why pharmacies, when they prescribe their drugs, always have a warning. Please follow your physician's prescription instructions precisely. And many pharmacies will verbally repeat those to you. So then you can't sue them. You've been warned. If you know it's going to take 4 half times to get to the desired steady state dose, taking 4 tablets at once isn't going to get you there any faster. It will just get you to a higher level. And as you go up in concentration, you're not only moving up this curve, you're also moving up this curve. They might not even be the same shape. This one might be really shallow. This one might be really steep. This is sort of an idealized view of it. But the ratio between the two, the therapeutic index, is an important piece of information. You'd like that number to be as high as possible. There are some drugs on the market with the therapeutic index is as low as 2 or 3. They're not widely marketed. They're targeted at very specific populations, but there aren't any good alternatives. But in that case, they need to be monitored really closely because the danger of an overdose is very high, particularly if they have problems clearing the drug. Because if you don't clear it normally, that's going to keep the drug on board, and the next dose you take is going to get added on to it. You already have a board.
Yes. When we're looking at the graph that showed the drug concentration in respect to the intensity of the effect, is that is it reaching steady state as it reaches the asymptote, or is that only for a single dose?
It reaches steady state when it gets to that asymptotic level. So putting more in, you're losing drug as much as you're adding to that additional dose. Okay. All right, another thing with most drugs, you don't typically, for most drugs, only take them once. Whether it's something that you bought at a party or something your physician prescribes to you. For any typical drug, you'll have some type of a life cycle for that drug. You'll take it in, it'll go up, it'll go down, because you've got potential storage in other parts of the body. It might take longer to go down than you might expect.
eventually it will clear out of the system. For a lot of drugs that have particular hazards associated with them, the next time you take exactly the same dose of the drug, you again have a curve describing concentration, or at least in this case, the effect. And then the effect will diminish. This could be a typical curve, for instance, for heroin. And for the hedonic value of heroin, the pleasurable effect, the reason why people seek heroin out, at least when they're initially sampling heroin. First time, they like it a lot. And then the effect fades. They talk it over with a friend that was there, and go out and try to find some more. But even though they get the same amount, the effect is not as good. We call this tolerance or desensitization. For many drugs, that develops very rapidly. And we'll talk more about this next week. In fact, it gets to the point where for some people to get anything even close to the initial effect, they might have to take 10 or 20 times the dose and still not get to that same peak effect. Then they might go to rehab. If their name happens to be Lindsay Lohan, or they might be clean and sober for 3 whole days. Or maybe for 3 weeks, or 3 months, or 3 years. But eventually, they might have an opportunity to sample the drug again. And in that case, typically, they're no longer in this desensitized state. They're typically back in a state much like what they were initially. We call that further stage recovery. That sounds good, right? Recovery? What you tend to aim for in rehab. But biologically, the system has recovered as well. So now if you were used to taking 10 times the initial dose to get an effect that wasn't even half of what you originally expected, now the system is ready to give you the full effect at the initial dose. And very often, when people relapse, they also overdose, particularly with drugs like the opiates, or with amphetamines, or a number of other drugs we'll talk about this semester, with what can be very lethal consequences, because the biological system has readapted. So we'll talk about these adaptive type of responses as we go through the semester as well. Okay. I think that's enough for today.